There's something sort of mystic about the union that I always think about. It's like that moment where you're on that picket line and it feels like you're just chanting like in a crowd, or when you march on the boss and just remind your manager that it's the workers who run the shop. That to me continues to be like the most powerful I've ever felt. The first time that we marched on the boss and they did not know what to do.
A lot of my job is just trying to get a read on whether a candidate is for real and whether they're going to stand with us after they get elected. And so you're just trying to tap into the core of who they are, because everybody's going to make promises on the campaign trail. It's the folks who are willing to fight with you on those tough decisions afterwards that makes a difference for our members.
Justice takes many forms and many hands. I'm Shane Murphy Goldsmith, President and CEO of Liberty Hill Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to Season 2 of Conversations from the Front Lines, where we tackle some of the most challenging social justice issues of the day with heart and honesty. This season, we're focusing on the topic of power, politics, and solidarity in LA. We've gathered some of LA's frontline political and community leaders to go behind the scenes of the fights for social change, the efforts to build community power, and the work to increase solidarity across movements. Get ready for some frank conversations and real talk on Conversations from the Front Lines. Hello, everyone. I am so excited to be here today with two brilliant young organizers and change makers, Hugo Soto Martinez, City Council member for Los Angeles City, and Jared Rivera, political director at SEIU 2015. So happy to be with both of you. Thank you so much for taking time to spend with us today. And I'd like to just start by giving you both the chance to share a little bit about yourselves, including what has you most fired up right now.
Thank you so much, Shane. I've known Jared for many years now. I'm very happy to be here for sure. So my name is Hugo Soto Martinez. I'm the council member for District 13. So if you live in Silver Lake, Echo Park, Atwater, Glassell, little bits of Koreatown and Westlake and Hollywood, of course, you probably voted for me, or maybe you didn't, but I'm now your council member. I organized for Unite Here Local 11 for 16 years. So I've been around the country with workers and immigrants and you name it, uplifting people. And what has me fired up right now is just really what we can do in the city of Los Angeles. We elected a whole new council, an amazing mayor, and it seems like for the first time in my life, I feel incredibly optimistic about what we can accomplish. So that's got me fired up.
Awesome. Love it. Jared, how about you?
Hi, everyone. My name is Jared Rivera. I serve as the political director for SEIU 2015. It is an honor to be here with Shane and also with you, Hugo. SEIU 2015 is the largest local union in the state of California. We represent a little more than 400,000 long-term care workers all over the state. Politically, it means we engage from the county supervisor level and city council all the way up to U.S. Senate and president, so plenty of work to be done. I live in Los Angeles in Highland Park. I also have the pleasure of serving as the co-chair of the Liberty Hill Board, so it's great to be home right now. And what am I fired up about? I think I would say two things. One, there is so much energy and tension around housing policy in the state, and I think it's really responding to just the incredibly terrible situation that we've created. And so there's a number of solutions, particularly at the state level, also local level, with things like Measure ULA that are causing all kinds of friction. There's inter-labor fights with this. And so it's a really vibrant time, I think, to be involved in the issue. And I got my start as a community organizer with the PICO network, LA Voice, and we were doing tenant organizing 18 years ago. And so it's something that's really near and dear to my heart. And then the other thing is, you know, for our local union, we are fighting to move to statewide collective bargaining. We have a bill this year that we'll be running. We go county by county right now, which is incredibly difficult and really doesn't maximize the power of our membership. And I think this hopefully will capitalize on the respect that our members deserve. So big fight ahead of us in this legislative session, but it's a fun one.
Great. Hugo and I have only met recently, although I did serve many years ago as the district director for CD13 and then later as a legislative aide. So I have roots in CD13 and in City Hall. And of course, Jared and I have known each other from the days when you were at LA Voice, which was when we were small children.
That's right.
Right.
Six-year-olds, I believe.
I think so, yeah. And now we're full circle. You were a grantee. Then we were kind of allies. Now you're my boss as the co-chair of the Liberty Hill board. So happy to have you in the mix, Jared, and to get to spend some time with you, Ugo. So I would love to hear from both of you. We'll start with Ugo. Just tell us a little bit about your kind of personal story. What was it about your upbringing that made you into the person you are today and doing the work you do today?
Thank you so much. I talk about that a lot on the campaign. So my parents were street vendors. They migrated here from Mexico. They had six kids. I was the second oldest. And so I grew up literally on the family business my whole life, out there selling fruit, being the free labor for my parents in very Mexican tradition. When I was about 14, my dad got hurt. And so literally as soon as I could work, I started working at a hotel, at a non-union hotel in downtown LA. And I worked that job through high school and college. And literally my senior year, as I'm getting ready to graduate and doing my resume and everything, you know, a senior does, the union came to organize it. I knew a little bit about unions because my mom eventually left the street vending business and became a member of SEIU USWW, the janitors. You know, I joined the fight. I dropped everything. I was going to go to law school, but I joined the fight. And when we won that union, it was just like transformational. I mean, I've never seen just normal working people, many of them monolingual, actually win. We won our respect. We won our dignity. Like, we took it from them. And we got a contract out of it with all kinds of stuff and raises and benefits. And I was like, wow, this is incredible. So I didn't go to law school. My mom was very pissed. The rest is history. And that shapes my entire life, just not having a voice, fighting in a collective spirit, building community, trying to just bring equity to the world in a militant union way. My life is shaped by those experiences.
I have so many questions about that, but I'll let Jared go.
I was born in Central California, but we moved to the Inland Empire when I was pretty young. Growing up, I think probably what drew me to organizing initially was somewhat of a feeling of otherness, trying to figure out who I was, because on the one hand, my father grew up in Michigan. His family started in Texas, and they kind of followed the crops from Texas to Michigan, where they ended up working in the fields and then later working on dairy farms. And so he was first generation Mexican American. But when he turned 18, he joined the Air Force and was stationed in England, which is where he met and married my mom. So I kind of had this kind of interesting growing up. I grew up in Southern California, but the immigrant parent that I had was from England, right? And so I think I was highly attuned to issues of race. And a lot of it was just trying to figure out who I was and kind of in this space in between. I think that's what kind of drew me to organizing, was really trying to understand people's stories. And then because I grew up with these stories of my dad and, you know, his nine brothers and sisters in the fields, I was fascinated by the farm worker struggle. So as a high school student, and when I got to college, I kind of read everything that was out at the time about Chavez and about the farm workers. I don't know when I learned what the term organizer was, or I don't know when I learned that you could get paid. I think we all kind of learned that when Obama started running in 07. I don't know that that was in my lexicon when I was in college, but at some point I figured, well, I think Chavez did this for a living. I think he got paid. And so maybe I could go work for unions. And so my first job out of college was with the California Nurses Association. And I spent a couple years organizing hospital workers. And it was just trial by fire. I mean, I was 22 years old trying to organize respiratory therapists, you know, and who had been there for decades. And but that feeling of being in the hospital cafeteria, when we have management on one side and you have workers on the other side, and they go by and they tally the votes. And when it becomes clear that the workers have won a union, it's just a joy. And it's just pure democracy in a way that I had never experienced. And so from there, did some community organizing and ultimately landed on more of the political side of the union. But I think at its core, it's really just about uplifting the voices of everyday folks and helping them find a dignity that is not afforded in our society. It's certainly not afforded at the workplace very often, unless you have a structure that workers have put together in the form of unionism.
Oh, such powerful stories. One theme that I kind of see between the two of you is both started out, in your words, Jared, feeling this sense of otherness, Ugo feeling like you didn't have a voice. And now you're two of the most powerful people in LA politics, I'll say. What's that like, sort of existentially? What do you go through to go from a place of feeling so marginalized and so powerless to feeling and having so much power?
I would say definitely Jared is more powerful than I am. Truly, like, the power does come from the grassroots. I always say, like, there's something sort of mystic about the union that I always think about. It's like that moment where you're on that picket line and it feels like you're just chanting, like, in a crowd, or when you march on the boss and just remind your manager that it's the workers who run the shop. That, to me, continues to be, like, the most powerful I've ever felt. The first time that we marched on the boss and they did not know what to do. They were like, why are there 50 workers in the general manager's office? And every single manager in the hotel appeared at that office because they were like, what is going on? Being elected official, yeah, of course, there's a lot of power to that, but nothing ever beats that rush of adrenaline when the workers come together and fight. I mean, that's just, it'll always be my favorite. I still love doing it to this day.
But Ugo, now you're the boss and people are going to be marching on you. How are you going to deal with that? Maybe it's already happening.
Yeah. I mean, we get a lot of chat on Twitter. So I'm waiting for the day that they come storm the castle. And I've learned from the best managers that the best way to diffuse that is just to listen. Because that's all people want. They want you to listen. I'll be fine when it comes.
Jared, what's that journey like for you?
It's an interesting question. I certainly don't think of myself as powerful. I'll speak for myself. There's always a healthy bit of imposter syndrome that creeps in when you're sitting at these tables. I'm certainly no council member, so my colleague here is more powerful than I am. We're low-wage workers. I mean, our folks are making, in most cases, just a few dollars above minimum wage. Most of them do not have access to any type of retirement security, including Social Security. Many of them are not paying into Social Security, very limited healthcare benefits. And yet, I do think we can say that our local is one of the most powerful entities in California politics. And it's really only because so many everyday folks have come together. And so that is something that gives me a tremendous amount of pride. It's also something that I treat with great care and take a tremendous amount of pride in the work that we do and on who we endorse and on the issues that we take up. I mean, it is in no way theoretical to me. When I think about our ability to engage in the political process and the resources that we have at our disposal, there are individual union members that come to my mind that are contributing $10 a month into this, you know, so I just always have to feel like I'm doing right by them. And I'm just so appreciative that I started the earlier part of my career in organizing, because I just think that discipline of hearing someone's story and sitting with them and kind of inviting them, and you do it likewise, to share your story. And it's just such an incredible skill. And I use it every day when I'm dealing with our members or even when I'm sitting with candidates. A lot of my job is just trying to get a read on whether a candidate is for real and whether they're going to stand with us after they get elected. And so you're just trying to tap into the core of who they are, because everybody's going to make promises on the campaign trail. It's the folks who are willing to fight with you on those tough decisions afterwards that makes a difference for our members.
I want to chime in a little bit here. Jared's, his latter points were like very resonating to me, because when I think about power, it's true. I have my hands on a lot of levers, but who do you wield it for? Who are you accountable to? When I was like running political campaigns, I would always think, well, who is this person accountable to? And even to this day, people would ask me, well, who are you going to vote for? Like, which elected are you going to vote for? And I would always say, look, I don't care what they say. They're all going to say what they say. At the end of the day, when there's a firefight and they're going to make a decision, they're always going to go to the people that they're most accountable to, the people that they listen to. That's how I view like a lot of the decisions of power. I mean, it's what Jared is saying. It's like, yeah, they're going to come in and say all these great, beautiful things. But at the end of the day, who are they at their core, right? Who is the community that they listen to? So I'm just very happy to say that I wield it for the working people of the city, right? SAU 2015 is like one of those entities that represent the working people of Los Angeles. But I think that's very important when we think about like what power is.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question about who you're accountable to. You had a career for many years where it was very clear who you were accountable to. Now, you know, I imagine that it's a little more difficult to figure out who those folks are and what that means for the positions you take. And in the case of Ugo, that may mean that you have a strongly felt principle that may align with some portion of your constituents, but maybe doesn't align with all of them. And Jared, in your case, I mean, I imagine there's some tensions between advancing the immediate interests of your members, like in collective bargaining or something very specific to the union. And then you also have this greater good that you're advancing as part of the union. So I'm curious for both of you, maybe we can start with Ugo, who are you accountable to and what does that mean for everyone else that's in your district?
I mean, I was very straightforward with folks. I'm here to represent the people who have not have access to power. And that's actually quite a big percentage of people in the district. In fact, I would say it's like probably like 90% of the folks. Because when you look at the decisions being made in Los Angeles, even middle class folks or even wealthy folks like just don't have like access to power. Now, obviously, the folks left out the most are like the working poor of the city. We look at housing. Well, that's a $3,400 one bedroom apartment. Like that's going to affect a working class person more. You know, who's being homeless? Who's being thrown into the streets? It's those folks. I was not shy from saying that. And we won because I think we spoke to the majority of folks in the district. I mean, 70% of the district are renters in CD13. Now, that doesn't mean that we're only going to listen to them. No, because, you know, coalition and working in communities about understanding other folks as well. We have to recognize that the scales have been tipped on one direction for far too long. We're just trying to move it in the right direction. We're not asking to have more power. We're just asking for equality. We're asking to have an equal voice in the process. So far, it's been okay, but you know, we've only been 3 months in. We'll see how it goes for the next 45 months.
Jared, how about you?
Yeah, I think this question of kind of who are your people is such a core issue, whether you're an elected official or you're doing movement work. The challenge that we always have, I kind of tell folks that before I got into this specific type of work that I'm doing now, I didn't realize how much effort it took to maintain the status quo. And so we want to dream big to push forward and create real progressive policies that change people's lives. But fighting back on budget cuts every year or on the erosion of our rights, that takes a tremendous amount of work too. And so like an example that I use is maybe 3 years ago, we got the permanent restoration of a 7% pay cut to our home care members. That was enacted in the Schwarzenegger administration. And so every single year that was put in the books and every year we had to go back to the Capitol to prevent that 7% cut from being executed that year. And we did that for 10, 15 years. And so that's not moving the needle further, but it's something that we had to do on behalf of our membership. And also our members have formed a union because of their work. And so we're thinking first and foremost about pay and working conditions, but we've also made it really clear that we're looking at the entirety of our members' lives. And our members are also renters. They're also folks that are sending their kids to failing schools. They're also folks that are engaging with the criminal justice system in all kinds of different ways and over-policing in their communities. And so we have to do those balances too. And Ugo was talking before about like everybody makes the same promises on the campaign trail. And I think that's true. And what I've kind of come to see is you only have a few opportunities to show what you're really about. Because in most cases, most votes you're taking at the state level or locally, you're just piling on a vote with a whole bunch of other people. It's not controversial. And in, say, every legislative cycle, it comes down to one or two votes that really show you if you're willing to take risks. And it's true for the work that the union does too. There are certain moments on housing fights, on electing the right DA, on ousting sheriffs that we have to step in and show that we're willing to take the fight. But it's part of why I value the relationships with other movement allies so much, because we're not going to lead on these. That is not going to be what we wake up every day. And so we really rely on other people in the movement to bring opportunities to us where we can use the political power that we may have on an issue. But that kind of energy between different spaces is so crucial.
Yeah, I love that. We're very interested at Liberty Hill in this kind of inside-outside game. And of course, Liberty Hill Foundation funds all the outside groups, putting pressure on folks on the inside. But we have lots of allies like you, Ugo, clearly on the inside. Jared, I think we could make a case that you're an insider and an outsider. But I'm curious, what is your sort of philosophy on how to strategically do this inside-outside game in your current role, which in your case, Ugo, I imagine it's a big shift. So I'm curious also kind of how your ideas about how to play that game have evolved. And I know you've talked a lot about co-governance and sharing power with the folks that you're accountable to. So I'm curious how that sort of inside-outside philosophy, how are you engaging with folks on the outside? And to Jared's point about the key votes that really matter, you've had some no votes that you knew you were in the minority and you did it anyway. So curious also about kind of how you're making those decisions.
Yeah, this has been sort of the most interesting part. We're a little bit of uncharted territory because this is the first time in my memory that we have at least Eunices and I who have been kind of dyed-in-the-wool organizers sort of in there. So this might change over time, but something that James Lawson would talk about a lot, right? He's played like a key role in the union and the civil rights movement, and even here in the labor movement, would always say is like everyone has to play their role. I know my role has changed. When I was a leader in Unite Here Local 11, like I played a role in trying to make the union more intersectional, to engage in like fighting the sheriff, supporting Gascon, right? Very similar to some of the things that Jared has done in his union. And now like I got to talk to the most conservative council members in council. Like I got to try to find common ground. At the end of the day, we can wish for all these amazing things, but I'm talking like a politician now. You got to count to 8. We need 8 votes, right? And like I learned that very quickly. It's like you need 8 votes. Recently joined on with Tim McCosker. He's very pro-labor, but used to be a lobbyist with LAPPL. But we both agreed that police officers get off too easily. They don't face accountability. They don't get fired. The whole process is just incredibly incorrect. But at the same time, I don't want to lose my roots with the people on the ground. And so good case in point is the tenant protections, right? Like, you know, without revealing too much, right? We're like, can we even get 1 of the 3? Like that was the discussion at first. And I was like, oh, hell no. Nah. Like, we got to build some pressure. Like, let's get a letter campaign going. Let's do a press conference. Let's mobilize people. Let's door knock. Let's put pressure on the swing votes. And so having that insight from the inside and being able to point and say, hey, you know, y'all are doing the work out there. These are the folks you need to go to, and right? Giving them guidance and clarity. And so they know as much as possible, like what's going on the inside informs the outside strategy, right? And so we were able to offer that, and I think in a very clear way that I think helped us, you know, win some of the best tenant protections in a generation.
Ugo, can you tell our listeners who may not know who the beloved and revered James Lawson is?
He's truly a national treasure, led the Memphis sit-ins, desegregated that city, was one of the key folks guiding along Martin Luther King and Gandhian nonviolent direct action tactics. And a lot of people don't know, but James Lawson moved to Los Angeles and eventually helped create the foundation of the labor movement for Mai Garcia and Marilena Durazo in 2 different unions, and one at SEIU and one at Unite Here, or HGRE at the time. And so a lot of that belief is very much present in the labor movement in Los Angeles.
We at Liberty Hill had the honor and privilege of working with him to launch his National Leadership Institute, which we incubated at Liberty Hill, and it was such a joy to be in his presence. Jared, what about you?
As I think about the inside-outside strategy, I mean, I guess there's kind of 2 things that come to mind. So number one is just counting votes. Ugo talked about that. Can you get to 7? Can you get to 41 in the assembly? Can you get to all the different votes that you need? And so sometimes we're doing work with folks just to get them elected because they're going to be that 38th, 39th, 40th vote. But then I think also, at least for me, I spent a lot of time talking to candidates to try to make guesses about who are going to be those elected officials who are going to shift the needle, who are more than a vote, but somebody who is going to really change the narrative on an issue. And those are folks we want to make investments in early and really try to bring them in as allies so that we can have somebody inside that we can think about and strategize with and dream with. And so there's a healthy amount of tension there, because I think for us, where it plays out a lot is backing incumbents or not backing incumbents. And when do you make those decisions? Every incumbent is going to be, for the most part, good with you on some issues, but not on those really tough ones that we talked about. I get a lot of people approaching me in my position that want to take on an incumbent. I always call it like the AOC effect, right? They're going to shake up, completely change the landscape. They have a movement on the ground, and people don't remember the fact that, well, 90% of incumbents are going to go through, right? People remember these opportunities where someone did it, but they don't remember all the other ones. Those are risks that are we have to weigh, right? And so when Ugo was running, it was the same thing. And we had a conversation, and and he was going up against an incumbent, and we honestly were not there in the primary with him because we weren't sure yet if this was going to shake out. But then our membership to, you know, move with him in the general, because we could see with him that he was somebody who was going to do the work. He was going to campaign hard and do all the things that people don't like doing when they're campaigning, raising money, putting a real field program together, all that stuff. But we thought he's going to win, or we think he's got a good chance of win, and he's going to change the narrative. And so those are those things that we think about a lot too, or about what are those risks that you take, because you go up against an incumbent and you lose and you're shut out on your primary issues, you know? So it's not something that we take lightly, but I think kind of the anchor of a good inside outside strategy are those handful of just warriors, the Maria Elena Durazos, the Isaac Bryans, the Ugos, these folks that are there that are going to strategize with you and think with you about how to get things done.
Jared, you said that you and your union role aren't necessarily going to wake up every morning thinking about the sort of bigger picture issues, and you're relying on community organizers and others to bring this to you. And so I'm curious, what's your advice to organizers? I mean, in a way, in this question, you're sort of the insider in the inside-outside game, because a lot of folks on the ground, organizers and community folks, feel like the labor movement and labor institutions are as impenetrable, if not more, than elected offices. And so how does an organizer who has an issue that they know affects your members, but that isn't the top priority for SEIU 2015, what's your advice for how they should bring issues to you? And can you just also briefly remind us what your actual job is? I'm not sure you said it, and I want people to know what a big labor boss you really are.
So I'm political director for SEIU 2015.
What is that?
That means I run the political program for the local. And so the work follows kind of the calendar year. So in election years, our primary job is to elect pro-worker champions and pass pro-worker initiatives. On off years, if we have any anymore, we do a lot of work around the state budgets in the Capitol. And so it's kind of creating urgency on the ground to pass key legislation. And then, as I mentioned, we also have these county contracts that are always happening. So a lot of the work that we're doing is trying to get to three votes in a place like Lassen County or Fresno or Lake or San Bernardino, some really tough places. So at the core, it's about building maximum political power with our members to achieve the goals that members have set out.
And what's your advice to organizers?
I think my advice to organizers in general is to get really clear about assessing your own power and the power that is needed for a key issue. That is a discipline that I'm not sure enough folks develop, that this is me in kind of my jaded old age. What's going to move me is not why we should do it or we should do it or that. Those are kind of givens. That's going to be an assessment about whether we can do it. And I'm not saying that we have to agree on the assessment of the power you have or the power that's needed. I'm just saying, are you really being realistic about, you know, your own power? It's not now. I mean, years ago, we would be doing, sitting around the table and people had these huge ideas and these huge goals. And you're sitting there thinking, we don't have the power to do that. We don't have anybody who's willing to carry that legislation. We're nowhere near the votes that we need. And so when folks come to me, I mean, that's the first question that I'm going to have. And to be honest, frankly, a lot of times when folks come to me, they have a big price tag that's attached to it. Oh, we have this great idea and we would love the members of your union to put down several million dollars for this great idea that we have, right? You got to do your work too. And we may come in and we do make sizable contributions on campaigns like a Measure ULA or other ones that are really important to us. But we're also not an ATM. You know, our membership is not looking to fund every idea that folks have out there. So I got to hear about why you think this is possible now and what you're bringing to the table. If what you're bringing to the table is just a technical expertise, okay, that's something. But if you, what you are purporting to bring to the table is engaging the community, mobilizing folks and all that, then that's got to be real. And we got to see evidence that you're willing to go out and do the hard work. And it's not just an idea that's in one person's head.
You both touched upon the housing crisis. And, you know, Jared, I think you mentioned some of the labor fights that sort of undergird both the progress and pitfalls in advancing a housing justice movement. And Ugo, you're one of the key leaders to make LA City one of the strongest cities in protecting tenants. And Liberty Hills prioritized this work because, one, we know that a lack of tenant protections causes people to fall into homelessness and is a huge contributor of our homeless crisis, but also because that's where the organizing is. And so just briefly curious, Hugo, what do you see on the horizon as real transformative solutions around housing? And Jared, what do you think is sort of the labor story beneath that? And what are we going to need from the labor movement to move the needle?
Yeah, on the issue of housing, I mean, it is such a major issue, especially in the city of Los Angeles. I mean, we're the homeless capital of the Western Hemisphere. Every single day, there's over 60,000 people in LA County that are living in the street. In order to get out of that, we have to just change every way we look at housing. And so one of the things that I'm the most excited about that I hope happens is some of the stuff that's in Measure ULA, which incredible what, you know, SAU 2015 did, because there's parts of it that's going to allow for social housing. There are countries that the government is providing housing, like housing is a human right or is a basic human need. It's not viewed as like something that is driven by profit. That seems very obvious to me. It's not obvious to people out there, right? And so to change the view of what housing is, I think it's going to be incredibly transformative, and not with the negative connotations, right? I grew up in Watts. Sorry, I went to school in Watts, and there was like the housing projects, right? Like that's when people think social housing. Like, no, like even that sort of paradigm used to be broken. And to look at other models where it's beautiful housing, it's holistic, it is welcoming, it's loving to the community. If we could do that and have the city be behind it and like really accelerate it, I mean, I think it could be a total game changer for working people.
And just to jump in there, ULA that both of you mentioned is United House LA, was a ballot measure in the city of Los Angeles that voters approved and will generate over $800 million a year, we think, to affordable housing development, tenant protections, homeless services. And many thanks to Liberty Hill donors who may be listening. Liberty Hill was one of the biggest, I think, if not the biggest, public foundation contributor to the measure, and we're super proud of the progress. Jared.
In general, what's exciting to me is I think that the electorate is hungry for change on housing in a way that elected officials are catching up to. I mean, you look at something like Measure ULA, you know, our union was co-chairs of that campaign. I mean, it was hugely important to us. Honestly, I'm not going to name any names, but it was difficult getting public officials to endorse it or to kind of own it, right? I mean, people were very quiet about that because there was still this idea that it's controversial. I mean, it passed, I don't have it in front of me, I think it was close to 59% of the vote. The electorate is telling you, this is what we want. I mean, we also, with my 2015 and Liberty Hill hats on, we supported folks in Pasadena passing rent control in Pasadena that also passed by 8 points there too in Pasadena, which, you know, you don't think of as a, you know, incredibly progressive kind of bastion, right? And so I think voters are really hungry for this. And so there's a little catch up because a lot of elected officials would not put something the scope of Measure ULA on the ballot if they had the opportunity to do so. And now it's going to be the largest infusion of dollars for affordable housing that the city has ever seen. Big deal. So I think we got to continue to look for those opportunities, referendums, I think all these things. We have to kind of show the elected class that you're not going to be judged for doing this. You're going to be judged for not doing this. And that is the real political price that you have to pay if people do not see changes in their local communities as it relates to encampments, if the experience that they have of going out and renting themselves, their children come back from college, they're looking to get their first apartment. Those are the liabilities that every elected official is going to have to deal with. And I think they have it backwards. You know, as it relates to labor, yeah, there is a big conversation that's happening within labor right now. And I think really what it comes down to is when you look at the issue of housing, how much of it do you look at it as a jobs issue? The jobs and the standards that you have for the jobs that are going to be used to create that housing. But then also, how much are you looking at it at the end result, which is the fact that our membership and all of our unions, they're all saying the same thing. We consistently poll our members and we say, what's the number one issue to you? What would you like to see the power of the union used to address? And it's a dead heat every time we do it between pay and benefits and housing, because we can fight like hell. We could go to a place and get a $2 an hour raise, the wage for home care providers in a county somewhere. And that would be banner contract for us. And it's going to be immediately by a $400, $500 increase to rent. And so I'm not saying I have the answers. It is a tricky thing because, yes, we want good union jobs. We want standards set for providing that, but we also want a scale in terms of the creation of affordable housing that we haven't seen because our folks are getting killed. During the height of the pandemic, our membership who was in nursing homes were working in some of the most dangerous jobs on the planet. And because they weren't given enough hours to any one facility because they didn't want to be given benefits, and because they have these long commutes and they have to put this work together, they were being put in a position where they're going to work at two or three different facilities. So they were both exposing and being exposed to the coronavirus and just transmitting all these different places. We had folks who were sleeping in their garages because they were too scared of going into the house. And a lot of that is being driven by the fact that they have these incredible commutes and they have to work more and more hours because they cannot afford the housing that they have. And so it's a big fight that we have going right now. I think it's a worthy conversation for us to have, but I'd rather be having this conversation with the support we have of the electorate, because I think there is an opportunity now that did not exist 5 or 10 years ago.
Ooh, powerful stuff. That phrase, the political price to be paid, is going to stick with me. So we're going to wrap up now with a fun question. Finish the phrase, the way to my heart is, Ugo.
Oh, through my stomach. I mean, come on. I love to eat. Seriously, my mom's love language is food. I mean, it's like very common. So yeah, but the way to my heart, feed me.
Good to know. Organizers, listen closely. Jared, what's the way to your heart?
My love language is golf. And so I would like to have really, really specific questions about 7 irons and keeping the ball low under the wind and how to get the ball to stop on the green. Just really, really boring.
And like touchdowns and stuff?
Exactly. Yes. That was a great touchdown on that drivable par 4 you had there. So, if we can move the meeting to the golf course, that would be great.
Golf and food. Got it. Well, thank you so much, Councilmember Soto Martinez and Jared Rivera.
Thank you so much, Shane. Thank you, Jared.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who joined us today for the second season of Conversations from the Frontlines, Power, Politics, and Solidarity in LA. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, and share this podcast with a friend who's interested in learning more about the fight for social justice. And that's a wrap.